Okay, I think we'll make a start. I just want to begin. My name is Matthew Jones from the LSE, by the way. I'm absolutely delighted to welcome you all here to this event. We've been planning this for a while, and it's a really, really pleasurable experience to see all of you gathered here. Thank you very much for everyone that's travelled from far and wide to come here, to be here today. I'm really pleased to see members of the Gowing family here to talk about their mother and her achievements, reflections on her life and her legacy for nuclear history in this country. I'm also really pleased to see students here, some of the students, my master's students from my class on nuclear history, so I think it's very important that we pass on this kind of knowledge to the next generation of young people and scholars. Now, the aim of today's symposium really is to tell two interconnected stories. First of all, we have Margaret Gowing's own personal story as a pioneer historian of the early nuclear age and a path-breaking practitioner of the genre of official history. This was a journey of a woman very much in a man's world at the time and who transcended the hard conditions of poverty in which she grew up to become, by the end of her career, the inaugural professor of the history of science at Oxford. As we shall hear this morning, London County Council scholarships took her from the Portobello Elementary School to Christ Hospital Grammar School and on to the LSE as an undergraduate in the late 1930s, where she specialised in economic history. She entered the civil service during the Second World War, and then in 1945, aged 24, joined the Cabinet Office team working on the official histories series on the civil side of the Second World War. And it's here that she honed her writing and historical skills as a member of a Cabinet Office team writing up the histories of the Second World War, of the British state and of the civil side of the war effort. After 14 years of hard toil, she was recruited in 1959 by the UK Atomic Energy Authority as its first archivist and historian. And it was at the AEA where she produced the work that has left an indelible mark on nuclear history in this country, and also on the history of the development of the British state. Now, the first book, which is of note here, was published in 1964, Britain and Atomic Energy, 1939 to 1945. Now, this was a book which related in hitherto unknown detail the way British scientists and their emigre colleagues had made crucial breakthroughs which helped propel the early stages of what became later the Anglo-American atomic bomb programme. And following this, in 1974, in collaboration, working in tandem with Lorna Arnold at the AEA, she produced two mammoth volumes, sequel volumes, Independence and Deterrence, which covered nuclear history from 1945, at the end of the war, to the first test of a British atomic bomb, the Hurricane Test, in October 1952. So she told the story here of how Britain became the world's third nuclear power. In 1966, Gowing had moved away from the Atomic Energy Authority, where she was offered and took up a readership at the University of Kent. But this part of her career did not prove so happy, as she juggled teaching commitments with completing work on Independence and Deterrence. However, when that book came into production in 1973, she was appointed to the first chair of the History of Science at Oxford. And there she helped to move the subject of the history of science away from its previous focus on the practical applications of scientific discoveries towards contemporary concerns with the social and political context within which the development of science occurred. And she also founded a contemporary centre for scientific archives at Oxford. So we'll have opportunities today to reflect on Gowing's family background and aspects of her career and rise to prominence, and to see the influence she exerted on historians in the nuclear field. But there's also a second story which is important to think about today, and it's intertwined with own, and that's of Britain's own early nuclear history. In 1981, Gowing wrote that the British nuclear programme belongs, quote, to that twilight period of history, the relatively recent past, where so often myth is a substitute for historical understanding. And an essential question she sought to answer in her work was why a medium-sized power such as Britain, a relatively low economic performer compared to some of its continental rivals, and beset with a huge task of domestic reconstruction after the war, became so determined over the years to retain its own nuclear deterrent. One reply she offered was that it was Britain's scientists in the first place who had played a leading role in the origins of harnessing atomic energy for military purposes during the Second World War itself. And this is a quote from her. "There is little doubt that without the British work, the Second World War would have ended before an atomic bomb had been dropped." It was this subject that formed one of the central themes of Britain and atomic energy, where her heroes were Bill Penny, James Chadwick, Henry Dale, and Christopher Hinton. These were giants of post-war science, or wartime and post-war science. She also detailed in her first book how Britain, having, as she put it, missed the bus in 1941, became a junior partner to the United States in the wartime atomic project. And it is the thread of Anglo-American nuclear relations that runs through much of her subsequent work and writing. Gowing would show that after the war, despite the huge expense involved, there was almost an automatic assumption by many in Britain that the country would continue along its own independent nuclear path and forge its own way in the nuclear business, especially once nuclear cooperation with the United States had been cut off in 1946. She pressed home the idea in her post-war volumes of British leaders and officials being at the forefront of deterrent thinking. The only answer to an adversary's possession of the atomic bomb was to have a similar means to retaliate. Without the sure knowledge of American support, the Attlee government decided to develop nuclear weapons. And this is another quote from Margaret Gowing. "From a fundamental and instinctive feeling that Britain must possess so climacteric a weapon. It seemed, moreover, a manifestation of the scientific and technological superiority on which Britain's strength, so deficient in manpower, must depend." But Gowing also saw Britain's early nuclear role and aspirations as obscuring the fundamental reality of Britain's changed status in the post-war world. Here, comparisons with European rivals were important, but also the nuclear programme increasingly became a way to maintain a place at the table, particularly in discussions with Washington, when major issues of war and peace were in the balance during the tensest period of the Cold War. This type of thinking became all the more salient with the arrival of thermonuclear weapons in the mid-1950s, when British governments were terribly conscious of the awful consequences of the escalation of great power crises into major war. So, the world of H-bombs and great power politics. It seems an awful long way from a difficult upbringing, North Kensington, and then student days at the LSE. And so what we're going to do today is try to weave these stories together of Margaret Gowing's own personal past and of Britain's nuclear history. And before we turn to the first paper this morning, where we look at her early years, I think Nick Gowing, Margaret's son, wants to say a few words. So, Nick, over to you.
Thanks indeed, Matt. Could you just, do I need to press anything here, Matt?
Oh, no, not really.
It's very audible, is it?
But I have a
way with microphones. But I'm speaking for James, my brother, who's sitting over there, and also all our the grandchildren, although Simon, our son, is not here. He's in Miami at an art festival. But can I thank you very much indeed? This goes back many months to recognize my mother. And James and I and the rest of the family, I think, also have another part of the story to share with you, because there really are a lot of paradoxes. And let me just commend to you the monograph, which is on your in front of you, from Roy MacLeod, who's Emeritus Professor of Modern History at the University of Sydney, who's got a long background in modern history at Cambridge and Sussex and here in London as well. It is a painful document in many ways, but it's something which I certainly contributed to, and James as well, about the paradoxes and the tensions. And as Matt has just said, my mother was brought up in essentially the slums of Portobello Road, imagine that now, where her parents had almost nothing and her father couldn't work, and she used her scholarship money, half her scholarship money, to keep them in basic foodstuffs. And it was that which led to the Leverhulme, which led to the LSE, which led to the first class honours degree. So there is this extraordinary story. And in fact, Nick Stern will be here later because his mum and my mother got on extraordinarily well in West London, not least on education issues. And when it comes to education, let me just tell you the kind of human stories we hope will come out today. My mother was very passionate. She was very socialist, very Labour, and she believed in state education. And she shared a platform once with Margaret Thatcher, who was Education Secretary. Now, if you look at the pictures, you'll see that there is a sort of vague similarity. And indeed, when Mum used to go into number 10 Downing Street, certain people used to think that actually it was Margaret Thatcher sneaking in when she had her straw bag full of confidential documents and archives and so on. But at the end, Margaret T. turned to Margaret G. and said, "You are rather good. Do come and see me in my office sometime." Anyway, that's a story my mother liked telling. But, of course, politically, they were at extremes. One of the wonderful enigmas to really unravel today is how a woman got on in Whitehall and also here as well, eventually progressing to the rare honour of election as a fellow both of the British Academy and the Royal Society. That's only a handful of people. And I think even she was amazed by that, given some of the many things that went wrong and were really tortuous in terms of her time at the University of Kent at Canterbury and also at Oxford as well. As she loved to say, "I didn't know an atom from a molecule." But she wrote the history of the nuclear bomb. Now, that takes a bit of unravelling. But as Roy highlights in the excellent monograph, she, quote, excelled at asking awkward questions of senior scientists and officials. And that's something which will come out early this afternoon as well. Now you know where I got my instincts from about asking awkward questions. For those of you who don't know, I have worked on television for many years. But in 1966, she became regarded as what was called a national treasure for her defiance and determination as a woman, even though in Oxford, having got the chair the history of science, contemporary history, she became oppressed by what she called the less than friendly atmosphere. It's predominantly masculine and traditional biases and what she called the forces of darkness. So that really highlights the kind of torture that she was going through. My father died in 1969. And therefore, obviously, it was quite a lonely existence. And that's what we want to bring out, the tensions of both the brilliance that she had, but also the personal challenges that were really difficult and never comfortable at all. And Oxford never held a high place in her affections, despite the honour they gave her, which we'll hear more about later. But as she wrote to Hugh Trevor Roper, "I am conscious of my failures rather than my successes." Final thought about what it means to James and me. We used to live in Canterbury, and I still have incredible memories of people I hadn't the first clue who they were, coming for dinner. My mother cooked dinner, often helped by Marks and Spencers. But famed nuclear scientists like Lou Kovarsky, literally a big bear of a figure, a white Russian who was a naturalized Frenchman, and he was one of the team that discovered neutrons in the fission of uranium-235. And there he was, sitting on a three-cornered chair at our Danish table, almost about to fall off. And my job was to make sure I sat next to him to make sure he didn't fall my way. But these are important people. And on one occasion, Niels Bohr, who developed heavy water and had to be exfiltrated to Sweden during the war. She talked of Los Alamos in New Mexico around the breakfast and dining table, and this chap called Robert Oppenheimer. Hadn't the first clue who it was, until I read the book, of course. And she visited James Chadwick many times in North Wales. It was an affectionate relationship. And where's Kevin? I was talking to Kevin, yeah. Because there's a bit which is recorded in the monograph about how she says to Chadwick, "What's going to happen to all these filing cabinets?" And he says, "I think I'll burn them." But Kevin's now been looking at the documents which are in the, is it the Churchill Library, you said?
The Chadwick page. Churchill,
yeah, okay. So in the end, things were balanced when it came to saving records, and that's one of the things she really wanted to do all the time. Rudy Piles, Mark Oliphant, Nicholas Curti, all these people were kind of household names, although I didn't really know who they are. Finally, brilliance had its oddities. I used to do a paper round, get up at 5:45 every morning, go and deliver the paper to the Vice-Chancellor, who my mother hated in Canterbury. I always made sure the paper was unruffled, and it was perfect when he read it at the breakfast table. But anyway, I'd come back, and there were occasions around the kitchen table where I'd find this enormous pile of documents. And they were actually documents that my mother had squirreled out of number 10, brought home in a straw bag and left them overnight because she got exhausted at 2 o'clock in the morning. And one of the oddities about a brilliant person is she could never remember the code number for the safe provided by the MOD. And it used to be a great attraction for ModPlod, the police at the MOD, that they would be asked to come down and open her safe so she could get her papers out. In the end, she said, screw that, and left all the papers sitting around. I dread to think, we never had a burglary, but they were safe in her hands. Finally, Sarah White, writing in The New Scientist, I don't think Sarah's here today, but the shining example of the liberated woman who managed to combine career and home successfully. But I think, as James and I would tell you, it was hard at times, and that's why we respect the brilliance of what she showed and what she's achieved, and the fact that people like you, after her death 18 years ago, are here to remember. Thank you, Matt.
Thanks. So we'll move straight on to talk about Margaret's upbringing and her early years as a student at the LSE. So we have here to talk to Sue Donnelly, the LSE archivist. He's been working on Margaret Gowing's early career at the LSE and early life, and Mick Cox. So, Sue. Can I
Which way do I go?
On the right.
Ah, there we are. So, Margaret Mary Elliott, as she then was, began her studies at LSE in October 1938, at the beginning of Michaelmas term. Interesting to note, she was in fact incredibly young. She was only 17 years and 6 months when she came to LSE. She wasn't yet 18. She'd come to LSE from Christ Hospital Girls' School, which was based up in Hartford. And much of this paper is going to be about how she came to be at LSE and the impact that had. As we've just heard, she was brought up in North Kensington, although by the time she came to LSE, the family address was actually Wembley. Her father was a motor engineer with poor health and long periods of unemployment, which meant that money was extremely short. Her mother had actually trained as a primary school teacher, but because of the marriage bar, she was unable to work. So with this question, with this background, a big question is, how did she manage to acquire such an excellent education? And the start is that she went to some London elementary schools. She actually attended two London elementary schools in Kensington, Portobello Elementary School and Oxford Gardens Elementary School. And she was among those who benefited from a desire by the LCC, which began in the late 19th century, to actually extend secondary and further and higher education to children from poorer backgrounds. In the late 19th century, the LCC had established something called the Technical Education Board, which was actually chaired by Sidney Webb, founder of LSE, and one of its big objectives was to extend the advantages of both technical and academic secondary and higher education to a wider groups of children within London. So children who were deemed to have attained a suitable standard at primary school were entered for an examination for junior and intermediate scholarships, which would fund them, provide for both the fees and also some living costs to attend grammar schools. They would get up to about £30 to £50 per annum for this. Alongside these scholarships to London grammar schools, there were also 8 scholarships awarded each year to allow London children to attend Christ's Hospital School, which had been founded in the 16th century. These would provide fees, board and lodging up until the age of 18 for children from families whose income was below £150 per annum. And Margaret Elliott was obviously noted by a teacher, put forward for one of the examinations, and acquired one of the scholarships. And indeed, a large percentage of the girls at Christ Hospital in Hartford at that time did in fact come from either endowed schools or the public elementary schools of London. Taking up this opportunity, of course, meant that she really needed not only the support of schools and teachers, but also the family. That the family needed to be willing to forego the immediate benefits of a small income from a child for the benefits of a larger income in the future. And I think it's clear that perhaps with Margaret's mother's background as a teacher and also her talking later of the way in which the family took advantage of the kind of free opportunities for education that London offered, that she was able to take up that support. Her career at Christ Hospital is not very prominent in the records of Christ Hospital. She appears as occasional mentions for athletics, and in the spring of 1938 she was highly commended in a recitation competition. So, however, it's quite clear that she had academic aspirations once she was getting to the age of about 16, because in February 1937 she wrote to LSE requesting pamphlets on the economics and commerce degrees and asking about scholarships. And in December 1937 she came to the school and she met the appointments officer and academic registrar, who was a woman, Eve Evans, who described her as a bright and promising girl. Her entrance interview was on the 22nd of March and was accompanied by a letter from her headmistress indicating that Margaret was not entirely well. But on the 23rd of March she received a letter from Eve Evans confirming that the school were not only going to award her a place but also a £50 scholarship, and that scholarship would be £50 for each year of her studying at LSE. At the same time, the school had put Margaret forward for the February examinations for the London Intercollegiate Scholarship Board, and she'd also been successful in that. And I think these scholarships are one of the things that are absolutely key to allowing Margaret to study here in the days before student grants or loans. And in fact, Margaret was actually relatively successful in obtaining scholarships. She had £100 a year plus her fees paid for LSE. She had £50 Leverhulme scholarship here at LSE, and she also had a £30 annual exhibition which went on throughout her LSE career from Christ Hospital. Indeed, at the end of her first year, when she won the Lillian Knowles scholarship for economic history, for getting the highest marks in economic history, it was actually decided by the school that although she would get the title of Lillian Knowles scholar, she wouldn't actually get the money. That actually went to another student, Barbara Wistock, who'd got the second best first in economic history. And it was felt that Barbara's financial needs were rather greater than Margaret's at the time. I'm not quite sure what Margaret thought of that. There's no comments from her in the file as to whether she would have liked the extra £30 a year. Another thing that crops up in the file is that she had a lot of support from her her headmistress, who was Nora Cicely Craig, featured here in a portrait from Christ Hospital. Under Nora Craig, Christ Hospital Girls' School had become a thriving boarding school with a strong academic record. She herself had studied at Royal Holloway College and had taken the Oxford Final Honours School in English Language and Literature, and then she'd gone on to do a Cambridge Teacher's Diploma and got a distinction in that. And she had moved to Christ Hospital from Saltburn High School up in the northeast of England. In fact, during her headship, a higher percentage of girls were receiving state scholarships than from the boys' school, Christ Hospital, which was then down in Sussex. Margaret's certificate of discharge from Christ Hospital, kindly supplied by Christ Hospital, shows that she left in July 1938, and she was getting excellent marks in Scripture, English, French, German and Latin, but no history. She was marked as either good or very good in everything, and she also won the Grinling Prize for Academic Excellence in Modern Languages. The file doesn't really go into great details as to why Margaret perhaps chose LSE, but one of the things we do have on the file is a little hint, a rather tantalising glimpse of perhaps a network of university-educated women who are now working in education and providing a stepping stone for the next generation. There's a letter from the school secretary, Eve Evans, to Nora Craig. And I mean, Eve Evans actually is quite interesting. It's quite interesting to know that whereas LSE is only just appointing its first permanent woman director, it had three senior women administrators before the Second World War. Mm-hmm. Eve Evans was actually the third woman to be school secretary, which indicates that they were on very friendly terms. They discussed mutual friends who they met for lunch, and Eve Evans also invites Nora Craig over to have lunch at the school. Eve Evans herself had studied at Royal Holloway. She'd studied classics at Royal Holloway. And although she was a little younger than Nora Craig, it is possible that they may well have known each other through the Royal Holloway connection. Craig thought very highly of Margaret, and her reference for the London Intercollegiate Scholarships Board describes her as a very keen worker with a decidedly good ability and power of acquiring a sound, ready grasp of a subject. She never shirks difficulties and delights in probing to the depth of a problem. She's also described as having an independent mind with a strong sense of social service. Margaret, I mean, the file being very official doesn't really give us Margaret's thoughts on why she chose LSE. Its openness to women students may have been part of it. Women had been part of the student body here from the very beginning and indeed had been on the staff from the very early days. It also allowed her to live at home, saving money and commuting in from Wembley. The availability of the entrance scholarships may also have played a part. And LSE's mix of evening and day class teaching, I mean, virtually every class was taught twice, once for students during the day and another for students during the evening who were working during the day. So there was a large number of students who may well have come from similar backgrounds, or at least some students who came from similar backgrounds, and she would not perhaps have felt as out of place here as she might have felt at some other colleges. Her working class background might not have been in a majority, but it would not have been unique here. So what was LSE like in 1938? Those of you who know LSE may recognise the old theatre. It hasn't actually changed a great deal. The chairs have. There isn't a window anymore. It was still a very small institution, 2,890 students. Of the regular day students, 572 were men and 370 were women. It was a very small site. The school had just opened the East Building, which we've just knocked down. You can see a big hole in the ground where it used to be. It was on the site of the old St Clemendane's Grammar School, and it provided the school with its second large lecture theatre and its first sports facilities on site. But most of the school was crammed into what we now call the old building on Houghton Street. Departments, libraries, refectories, common rooms, all crammed in. The school had improved its position academically as a social science institution under the director for most of the 20s and the 30s, William Beveridge. But in 1938, it had a new director, Sir Alexander Carr Saunders, who'd arrived from the University of Liverpool in 1937. He was to remain for 20 years and was mostly known as a very safe pair of hands, which was very much needed during the war. And although the institution was small, it had some very big names, which I know Mick's going to talk about, including Harold Lasky, Eileen Power, and Richard Tawney in economic history, and Lionel Robbins and Friedrich Hayek in economics. Margaret signed up for the BSc in economics. This is her application form, with French. And that's a degree which allowed students a really wide choice in subjects. I mean, yes. It was a bit of a standing joke you could do it without doing any economics, which isn't quite true, but, you know, certainly in your second and third years, you could do very little economics. In her first year, she attended Eileen Power's compulsory course for BSc Econ students on the growth of English industry every Wednesday between 12 and 1. And that the syllabus declares that the lectures will be throughout of an elementary character, but the syllabus describes the course as a sketch of the development of England with special reference to the period after 1760 revolution in the iron trade, in internal communication, in textile industries, agriculture, effect of the Great Wars, factory acts, industrial... In fact, it sounds like my GCSE O-level course, actually. In the same year, she would have also have done an introductory economics course, studied the British Constitution with Harold Laski, and also done a general regional geography course. At the end of the year, her tutor, Vera Anstey, wrote that she has a decided bent for economic history. And as I said before, she won the Lillian Knowles Scholarship for Economic History for getting the highest marks in economic history. And she also won the Gladstone Memorial Prize based on her results, which was a prize of £5 to be spent on books. In her second year, obviously having decided economic history was a good thing, she did three economic history classes. Economic History from 1485 with Richard Tawney, and then she did a course which Tawney and Eileen Power taught on economic history since 1815, and also studied the Industrial Revolution. And in her final year, she focused a great deal on economic history with Lance Beales, and also political history of the great powers. And of course, she had some formidable tutors, which I know Mick's going to talk about. Each of her tutors had their own comments about Margaret in her first year. I mean, here we have her tutor, got Tawney up here, Vera Anstey, who was economics and economic history, Lance Beales, and of course Eileen Power, the economic historian. The tutors all had their own comments. In the first year, Vera Anstey was her personal tutor and thought her a very able student who had made good progress. In her second year, Eileen Power was a bit more circumspect, a good student and without any very great originality, does thoughtful and well-arranged essays, obviously an excellent examinee, but at present very immature. She was actually still only 19, I mean, given that she'd started at 17 and a half. Jack Fisher had a slightly different view from Michaelmas term of the same year, a student of tremendous industry and quite terrifying efficiency. But he had a proviso. At present, she is too unimaginative to be first class, but this she ought to improve. She obviously did. And to the scholarships committee, to which they had to report each year to make sure she continued receiving her funding, she was described as the most conscientious and intelligent student who should get a very good result in finals. And Tawney described Margaret as vigorous and clear-headed. Margaret later acknowledged the benefits of these tutors and this teaching had had on her future career in 1988 when she wrote to the then-director, I.G. Patel, "I owe my interest in history generally, and to a lesser extent in the history of technology which underlay economic history, to LSE, for I had dropped it as a subject at school where it seemed a tedious, dynastic and bellicose business. I shall always remember Eileen Powell's history lectures for first year BSc Econ students, and later, when history became my special subject, the lectures and classes of Tawney, Beales and L.J. Fisher." Of course, Margaret ended up having, in some ways, a rather different experience of university than she had expected, because in 1939, after the outbreak of the war, she found herself studying in Cambridge, and no longer commuting from Wembley and living at home, but actually moving with the rest of the school, which was evacuated to Cambridge. Fortunately, the scholarships, the National London Scholarships Committee were willing to increase her maintenance grant so that she could cover the additional costs. The government apparently had wanted to split LSE between Glasgow and Aberdeen, but Carl Saunders had... I don't know whether that was to divide and rule or what, but the director had other ideas. And actually, by July 1939, he'd arranged with Peter House Cambridge that they would house LSE in the event of war. It was not perhaps an obvious choice. In many ways, LSE had more connections with Oxford than with Cambridge, even. But on the 1st of September 1939, the Ministry of Works took over Clare Market and Houghton Street, and LSE decamped to Cambridge, where they took over Grove Lodge, which is a large house and gardens, which I recently peered through the hedge next to the Fitzwilliam Museum, which is into this garden, I think, where students used to meet. The school, the number of teachers reduced to 46, which was half what it had been the previous year, and the number of students fell. 1939 to 40, it was down to 979, and in Margaret's final year, there were only 683 students. But the school managed, by Carl Saunders' great efforts, to continue to teach across its range of courses. But there were some big changes. LSE became largely an undergraduate school, which was very different from what it had been here at Houghton Street, or was to be again afterwards. It also increasingly became a women's college. In 1939 to 40, there were 359 men and 247 women, and in her final year, there were 255 men and 238 women. And by the end of the Second World War, there were more women than men studying at LSE, something which didn't happen again until very recently. By the end of the war, but overseas students, interestingly, continued to be a constant at LSE. So Margaret would have known students both from occupied Europe, but there are also significant numbers of Indian African students who found themselves rather left in Europe. LSE and Cambridge teaching became fairly intertwined in some areas, particularly economic history and economics. And teachers who remained at the school included many of the well-known names, including Hayek, Eileen Power, and Vera Anstey, and R.H. Tawney, until he headed off to the Washington Embassy. And Eve Evans remained as the senior administrator. Margaret managed to live in central Cambridge. The school's billeting officer was Vera Anstey, who would cycle round trying to persuade landladies that LSE students were entirely okay to have. At Beaver Terrace, she lodged with three friends, Sheila Lucock, Rosaline Holman and Helen Martin. And in fact, they asked to share together the following year, but by the look of their files, that didn't actually happen. I'm sure Vera Anstey had more on her plate than trying to keep four friends together in their homes. Interestingly, both Sheila Lucock and Rosaline Holman had an interest in politics. Sheila Lucock came from York and had signed up for the BSc Econ with Government as her special subject. And her father was a political organiser who was known to Hugh Dalton. Rosaline Holman from Wimbledon was actually the niece of Hastings Lee Smith, a Labour politician who had also taught public administration here at LSE, and her father had been the socialist candidate for South West Bethnal Green. The final member of the quartet, Helen Martin, has proved a bit more elusive. I haven't yet managed to track her down. But despite the deprivations and organisational difficulties, many remember Cambridge exile as a relatively good time. Anne Boehm, who was later secretary of the graduate school, who arrived as Margaret left, said, "I always say we had a happy war." Some thought that was a rather rosy view of a difficult period, but at LSE at Cambridge was a very small community. It was quite homogenous, and Carl Saunders felt there was a greater sense of unity amongst both students and staff. Student life was focused on Grove Lodge, where the New Shore Library of General Reading Books was lodged, and the place was full of signs, slogans and notices for clubs and committees. And of course, it was also at Cambridge that Margaret met her future husband, Donald Gowing, who was another Christ Hospital scholarship pupil. It's probably indicative of Margaret's background that she began to think about how she was going to earn her living quite early on in the process. I mean, she saw the school's careers advisor in her first year. She did some vocational tests that had been designed by the NIIP, I've forgotten what it's called. It was a psychology, and they actually designed the first driving tests. So, National Institute of Industrial Psychology, that's it. And she said she might be interested in the civil service or academic work. It was an interest seconded by a letter from Nora Craig, who said that Margaret had entered the school with no fixed idea of a career, except perhaps the administrative grades of the civil service. She had an increased interest in politics, and Miss Craig thought she might be a secretary to an MP or work for a political organisation. In the event, graduating during the war and with the family's limited means, despite a first-class degree, further academic study was probably not a viable option. And she began her working life in the civil service in the Ministry of Supply, which indeed allowed her to move on to her more academic career. So that's a little run through her life. It's clear that she came from a kind of early generation of working class children who, with the help of teachers and family, were able to push on what was still a very heavy door into future education. And that once in the system, she may well have benefited from support of a network, maybe, of other university women and the availability of places like LSE, where she might feel more at home.
Okay. Thanks very much, Sue. That's great. I'm going to fill in some of the gaps and take the story forward. This is also part of a much larger project in which I've been engaged for the best part of a year and a half. I'm trying to write what they call a new history of the LSE. I'm not quite sure how new it will be, but I hope it'll be new enough. And part of what Matt and I did with Nick's support was to bring this symposium together, one of the key figures at the school, and an interesting figure for all the reasons that have already been given, was Margaret Gowing. And that is what I'm going to talk about. And I'm going to start off with a general comment and then move on to the school. It is perhaps remarkable, I think, that two of the most important people in what some might have regarded as a very masculine topic, nuclear history, were women. That is to say, Lorna Arnold and Margaret Gowing. I think it's equally telling and remarkable that in our age of specialisation, that Lorna and Margaret, both by their own admission, knew nothing or very little about science before they entered in the field in which they made a reputation. And a third point, both would have admitted, and in fact did, that their later very successful careers as women writing nuclear history have been made possible because of two powerful men who, like a few men, rather than women at the time, had access to power. Lorna Arnold even describes the moment when this happened. You will find it in her short autobiography, My Short Century. It was a summer day in 1958, Lorna describes it. She was then working for the Spastic Society, as it was then called. Lorna decided to walk through Russell Square in the sunshine. She saw an Italian coffee bar, a very rare sight in London of 1958. She walked towards it and bumped into a familiar figure called Charles Plum, whom she had known from civil service days in World War II. He was in the Department of Health, but introduced Lorna the next day to, quote, an unnamed director of establishments who'd been a star performer at Bletchley. He then offered to send her papers to the United Kingdom Atomic Energy Authority. Interview and job followed. As Lorna says at the end of that chapter, quoting Dante, "Oh fortuna," she exclaimed, "chance in life." In Margaret's case, Margaret Gowan's case, it all happened earlier, during World War II, when she was already, as has been alluded to, working in the civil service. As Roy MacLeod, and you've got it in front of you, has described it, fate yet again took a hand, fortuna once more. She was spotted by Keith, later Sir Keith Hancock, described by MacLeod as a brilliant, quizzical, kindly, energetic, pipe-smoking Australian. An imperial historian and a Rhodes Scholar with an all-telling, all-souls background, Hancock, by the early 1940s, had already developed important, quote, Whitehall connections. And as a result, Hancock was approached in June 1941 by Sir Edward Bridges, Secretary to the War Cabinet. Bridges suggested to Hancock that he would like him to prepare a civil counterpart to the official military histories. Hancock did wonder whether it was worth beginning the job before the war had been won. Indeed, what would happen, he said, if the UK lost? Anyway, such doubts were put to one side. He agreed, that is to say, Hancock agreed to pull the series together. The Treasury, reluctantly and typically, approved payment for 10 historians. Eventually, of course, we know the whole series employed 25 and more, including, aside from Margaret Gowing herself, two historians who, like Margaret, either had or would have an LSE connection. Michael Postan, by now at Cambridge, and by the way, the husband originally of Eileen Power, and of course, Richard Titmuss, who, though without any academic qualification at all, tells you something about the time, had already acquired something of a reputation, having written Poverty and Population in 1938, Our Food Problem, The Parents' Revolt in 1942, parents weren't having enough babies, and Birth, Poverty and Wealth, which came out in the same year. Hancock, we know, developed an intense relationship with Titmuss, as Titmuss got on with writing one of the books in the series. Hancock later said that in his obituary, he would want it said that he found Titmuss. It was indeed a lucky find for Titmuss as well, who went on to author one of the more successful books in the Hancock series, Problems of Social Policy. Completed in 1949 and published in 1950, the book by Titmuss became a classic in its own right, exercising an enormous influence both on the way people viewed the home front during World War II and its benefits, and the way in which the welfare state evolved thereafter. The relationship with Hancock proved equally crucial for Margaret, as MacLeod points out. Many things attracted Hancock, who turns out to be a crucial player in much of this story, almost a pivotal figure in some ways, isn't he, Nick, you well know. Many things, of course, attracted Hancock to Gowing. Her intellect, her great capacity for work, but significantly too, politics, can never be left out. Both were social democratic. Both were also establishment outsiders in their different ways. He is an Australian and she is a woman, as has been pointed out, from a working class background. But how did the young Margaret end up becoming a published author alongside the very great Hancock? The story has been told by Jim Davidson in his definitive biography of the historian W.K. Hancock, A Three-Cornered Life. Hancock at first set out to write one of the books in his own series, all by himself. However, it was clear, as has been pointed out, by 1944, he was becoming, quote, overwhelmed by the task. And exhaustion was setting in. He would therefore need considerable help. Then, in late 1945, when things, to quote again from the book Davidson, were at a low ebb, there came along the perfect collaborator, Margaret Gowing. Hancock, we are told by Davidson, was soon convinced that Margaret was the right person. The new duo worked brilliantly well together. The relationship also changed from Margaret being the junior partner, dependent on the more senior man, to becoming, in effect, his intellectual and academic equal. Later, Hancock himself admitted she was, in reality, one of the two co-authors of the book, and the book, of course, was called The British War Economy, which finally came out in 1949. The book was brilliantly well received. It garnered five fine reviews. And by 1959, it had sold no less than 32,000 copies. Not bad. For Gowing, like her very close friend Richard Titmuss, and again, that connection is important, the relationship with Hancock thus proved transformative. For Titmuss, it led to a chair at the LSE in 1950 without a degree, let alone a PhD. For Gowing, it gave a massive boost to her career, nor did her work on the series end there. Another book, co-authored with E.L. Hargreaves, titled Civil Industry and Trade, appeared in 1952. This was then followed by a chapter in the same series, Studies in Social Services, edited by Ferguson and Fitzgerald. This came out in 1954. Hardly surprising, therefore, that by 1958, Hancock now ranked Margaret not just as the co-author of one of the books and a co-editor of one of the others, but actually the co-editor of the entire series. Nor was this all. As Roy MacLeod again points out, the legacy of doing the series, and this leads to something you said there, Matt, showed that it was in fact possible to reconcile being an historian with writing official history. As Hancock put it, the whole concept of official history, and these are his words, not mine, ceased to represent the prostitution of the profession and became rather an important contribution to understanding in an age when government policy balks so large. For Margaret, of course, there was another benefit, the prestige of working with the Cabinet Office with privileged access to top secret papers, and everyday access to leading politicians and civil servants. Indeed, it was through this work and because of her work in the 1950s, which also helped lay the foundation of the modern state record system in Britain. This in turn helped her move on in 1959 to go on to do what we are here today to discuss in more detail, her work on nuclear history. Though, even this might not have happened if she'd been offered the job she applied for as a reader in social administration at the LSE in 1955. Another LSE connection. So one that didn't happen, fortunately, in some ways. Of course, I'm bound to say that, I suppose, being an LSE patriot. But the LSE connection, as Sue has rightly pointed out, was indeed a crucial one for Margaret. It was perhaps no accident, I think, that she applied to the school in the first place, going back to one of the questions that Sue asked. The school had a reputation for political engagement with real-world problems. It was by no means an ivory tower. Still isn't. It tried to be open to all people of all talent, from all classes, and, I should add, from all sexes. As one writer who later reflected on the LSE in the 1930s, A.W. Coates, put it, he said the LSE had a distinctive ethos in the interwar years. As he points out, the environment at the school was far more conducive to sexual equality and equal social intercourse than in Oxbridge. It was also on the up under the leadership of William Beveridge, the fourth director. So by the time Margaret arrived here in 1938, there was a real sense of intellectual self-confidence around the place. One might add something else too, that when she arrived, she did so at a moment in the school's history when one can say, I think without exaggeration, that intellectual giants walked the length and breadth of Houghton Street. And Margaret was taught by nearly all of them in taking her broad degree, then called, by the way, BSSC Econ, which had very little economics in it, but did have some. The courses she attended in 39-40 in her first year tell their own story, I think, both about the school, who taught here, and what she, and who she learned from. For economics, she had Lionel Robbins, who taught all the first-year students at LSE, by the way. That's where he thought you got them early. For the course on money, she had that unknown Austrian called Hayek. And for labour market, which she took in the first year, she had Ronald Kozer. Robbins was already a massive presence in the school, and he effectively made the economics department here after having been appointed at a very young age to a chair in 1929. He in turn appointed Hayek and Kozer, who were later awarded the Nobel Prize each for economics. Finally, for political and social theory, she attended the hugely popular lectures, of course, the one and only Harold Laski. One can only guess, but the radical Laski must have made an impact. Indeed, when asked to choose something by way of a prize, she kept winning prizes. She won more than a few. She decided that one of his books, Laski's books, The American Presidency, alongside three books on art, by the way, and one on the Royal Institute of International Affairs study on nationalism, which had been chaired by E.H. Carr. She'd wanted those books. But then later on she discovered something. There were still 2 and 6 pence left in the kitty. Lovely, isn't it? I just adore this stuff. And she wondered whether she might not also add to the list. She said this in a very polite letter. She wrote very nice letters. Could I really have Laski's Hobhouse Memorial Lecture, Downfall of European Liberalism? Might be worth revisiting today. But even from her LSE record, it was clear, and again, Sue has written about this very well, so I'm only, in a sense, plagiarising Sue in many ways. It was economic history, and this is really crucial, it really does need to be brought out. It was economic history above all that inspired her. And the LSE was very well served in this particular area. It has been recently suggested that economic history might today be an endangered discipline and economic historians an endangered species. But it was one of the keystone subjects taught at the school since its foundation in 1895. Indeed, very early on, Webb, who was no mean man on these issues, brought in a man called William Cunningham, the eminent economic historian, to teach on a part-time basis, largely because Cunningham was an anti-individualist and didn't like Marshall up in Cambridge. Sydney was nothing if never not but political. Economic history was also taught by the first director, W.A.S. Hewins. On the title page of his first book, English Trade and Finance, Chiefly in the 17th Century, I love the chiefly, Hewins was described as a university extension lecturer on economic history. He went on, by the way, to advise Joe Chamberlain on imperial reform. And when Hewins resigned the directorship of the school at the end of 1903, it was decided there ought to be a full-time lectureship in economic history. That early. And in 1904, the job went to a woman, Lillian Tom, who a few months later became Lillian Knowles, or Mrs. Knowles. She was, in fact, the first full-time lecturer in the subject of economic history in a British university, though not the first chair. Lillian Knowles went on to become a reader in the subject at LSE in 1907, and in 1921 she was appointed to a chair. Incidentally, one of the many, many, many prizes that Margaret won was named after Lillian Knowles. Economic history at the school was in turn boosted massively by the appointment in 1912 of R.H. Tawney, who, by the way, came here under a Tata Foundation scholarship, lectureship, so India, in a sense, brought Tawney to the school, interestingly, and in 1921, after the First World War, by the appointment of somebody we've already mentioned, another great woman at the school, Eileen Power. Tawney and Power were very close friends and colleagues who produced their first three volumes on Tudor economic development in 1924. And 2 years later, Tawney published his classic, Religion and the Rise of Capitalism. And a year on, both Tawney and Power were central in establishing the English Historical Review, which was the first of the great economic history journals coming out of the school. And the two together clearly had a profound impact on the young Margaret Gowing, Eileen Power in particular. Power was a remarkable woman who, it is said, preferred the poetry of the avant-garde, fought hard for women's equality, and was highly active in the League of Nations Union between the two wars. She died suddenly and tragically in 1940. She taught as a student when he came here and later married Michael Postan, or Moshe Postan. But, and here's an interesting story, Sue, isn't it? She stood aside in 1937 to allow him, her former student, a free, and as it turned out, a successful run at the chair up in Cambridge, which was just then being vacated by Clapham. Aside from writing some very great economic history, Power was held very much an LSE loyalist, later remarking, of course, completely accurately, that she found the LSE, quote, a much more stimulating place to work in, and London a much more congenial place to live in than Cambridge. I'll always love her for that. But others too took their part in Margaret's intellectual formation at school, including, amongst others, H.L. Beales and F.J. Fisher, who you quoted, saying that Margaret at times displayed quite terrifying efficiency. We should also mention one other person who helped the young Margaret along, and that has also been mentioned, Vera Anstey, another woman, another economic historian, and Margaret's advisor of studies between 38 and 39. And by the time she met Margaret, she was already an established author, having written two books on India, the trade of the Indian Ocean and the economic development of India, both in 1929. And again, Anstey also had a very high opinion of Margaret, as Sue said, noting she was an excellent student with a scholarly type of mind with a decided bent for economic history. How true that turned out to be. Indeed, when looking back at Margaret's published output, between leaving the school in 1941 and her later engagement with nuclear history, her work was almost really entirely taken up in one way or another with economic history. Nor was Margaret herself backward in coming forward in admitting the debt she owed both to the LSE and to the economic historians at the school. And Sue has quoted from the letter, but I'll read it out in full. Indeed, it was a very revealing letter. Margaret had just been awarded her FRS, and the then director at the school was I.G. Patel, who succeeded Ralph Darendal. And in 1986, Patel wrote to Margaret, so congratulations on becoming an FRS. And Margaret, we don't have that letter, but we do have his reply, which you partially quoted from. And then she wrote back to Patel again, and this is what she said. And I think, and again, I'll quote it again, because Sue touched on it, but I'll quote it maybe in my own particular way, if you like. I owe my history in history generally, and to a lesser extent in the history of technology, which underlay economic history, to the LSE. She goes on that she had before arriving at the school, and that's that wonderful quote, dropped history as a subject. She dropped it because all it seemed to comprise of was tedious, dynastic and bellicose business. One damn king after another, one damn war after another. And that turned her off. But then things changed, she continues. I shall always remember Eileen Power's history lectures, and later, when history became my special subject, the lectures of the greats, the Tawney, Beals and F.J. Fisher. And then, of course, she makes that interesting point. She knew absolutely nothing about science. Her later interest in it also was accidental. I was looking for a history research job, she says in the letter, when the Atomic Energy Authority had advertised for an historian, an archivist, and I got that job. Fortunately, she concludes, there were still enough of the great scientists of the 1930s who were still alive, including Niels Bohr, and it was more than anybody else, who were very willing to explain things in simple terms to a non-scientist. Margaret Gowing may have gone on much later in life to have a very close association with two other universities, as we know, happy or unhappy, we can discuss, with the University of Kent and, of course, the University of Oxford. But if her own testimony is to be believed, and I think it has to be believed, it is evident that her years here at the LSE were critical in making her into the historian she was later to become. Thank you very much for listening.
Well, look, thank you very much indeed, both of you. That's tremendous. I've learned a lot already. And I lived... with this drama, with James, for so many years. So thank you very much for all you've done. One of the things that comes through loud and clear is, at least you could read her writing. Because much of what she wrote when she was scribbling, much of the archivist work she did, of course, there were no photocopiers, and obviously there was classification of the Official Secrets Act and so on, but everything had to be written by hand. And my goodness, the scrawl got worse and worse. So if ever there was a security or secrecy problem, no one would ever have managed to read her writing. So that was her defense. Remember that when you're talking about algorithms and artificial intelligence. Anyway, let's get some thoughts. There are so many distinguished people in the room, and indeed from those who are learning about the history of science, who've come here to learn what it was like. And I should tell you, when Matt talks about a massive tome, this is the massive tome, so big that it's massive two tomes. And that was 1974, and that was 10 years earlier.
It all came about by accident.
Yeah, I think you can still get it somewhere. Anyway, look, who'd like to come in and spirit the conversation? We've got so many distinguished people here as well. Tom, hello. Tom McCain. Would you like to just say who you are?
Yeah, I'm Tom McCain. My question was about her days at the Ministry of Supply, because Sue, you even said that her first job was with the Ministry of Supply. What was she doing, and how did that have any bearing on her future career?
She was actually a statistical assistant.
Yeah.
So I'm fortunate that she came to LSE, which was one of the few places teaching statistics in any
yeah.
form.
Yeah.
And she was working on iron and steel. But I think once she was into the civil service, she was then able to move. And in 1945, she moved to the Board of Trade in what doesn't sound a very exciting job, the Directorate of Housing Fitments.
Very cool.
But then she moved on to the War Office and got involved with the history of the Second World War. But I think her first job was she applied for the civil service. It was in the middle of the war. They needed statistics, people who at least had a passing knowledge of statistics. And in fact, I mentioned Sheila Lucock, who was the friend who shared with her. She went into the Ministry of Labour doing a similar kind of job there. And actually she writes back to LSE and says, oh, I'm in quite an LSE environment here. There are lots of us, you know, who've come from here who are doing these kinds of work. So I think it's kind of they go in they go into whatever they're needed to do at that point. Mm. And then because of her interests and her knowledge and her intellect, she's able to make contact and find a new way.
An additional, more general point. When Dear Sydney and Beatrice and George Bernard Shaw set the school up in 1895, the whole point was to create a school where, quote-unquote, to use Sydney's words, useful subjects were taught rather than Greek, Latin and the greats. And so in a way, I mean, what Margaret learned here, and then the war arrives, and you need useful people, you know, who can do useful things like statistics, war production, can work out how social services are to work and operate. I see Peter Hennessy back there, but you know, that this is where the LSE fitted in rather well into the Second World War effort. It's not to deny anybody else's role in that. It is quite extraordinary, actually, looking down the total list of people from the LSE, both students and staff, and their contribution to the World War II effort. And it is really quite remarkable. And most of that is in economics. It's in production and areas like that. So Sydney got it right, even if he may have got other things like the Soviet Union wrong.
Peter, Lord Hennessy. Peter Hennessy.
Thank you so much for those presentations. There's so many resonances from Margaret's life that matter. But one of them, I like Laurie and Patrick's comments, and Jill's too, is just how important official histories were to that generation. Mm-hmm. And here we were in the middle of a total war, and Bridges calls in Hancock. Hancock gently says, is this quite the right moment?
Yes, quite.
Central, he said, you need a... They used to call them funds of experience. But we may have to face some of this again, said Bridges, by remembering Hancock's so it's very important that we do this. We were strapped for cash. And now, to get official history the place it should have in current life, well, it's extremely difficult. The Foreign Office has lost its nerve in the possible dictatorship. The Foreign Office keeps going. And I think it's absolutely vital that a way can be found somehow of Margaret's resonance and the Hancock legacy and the Bridges legacy.
I'll just say one quick point on that, Peter. Thank you very much for that comment. I knew about the official, particularly on the social economic side, the industrial war production, and I'd never read them before until I actually read them, if you like. And the three I looked at were the one by Postan, the one by Gowing and Hancock, and of course the great volume by Richard Titmuss. And that is official history, but my goodness, what quality history it is. But you couldn't have done that research without the official side. You know, it's that kind of bring, and I think it's the ability to bring, in a sense, to redefine what you understand by official history. But as I think Hancock himself said, do you really want me to say this to Bridges? Do you really want me to do it? We might actually lose the war. Oh no, get on with it, you know. Yeah, so I don't know if anybody else would matter or anybody else.
Can I just go to Jamie first, Jill? Please.
James Shaney, so just a straightforward question, not a comment, but it would interest me. Margaret obviously was here during the final sort of stages before the outbreak of World War II, and both of you, thank you very much, for very interesting presentations, focused very much on the internal influences on her, obviously these sort of superstars, we would call them these days, intellectuals. But of course, in terms of what she later did, which was at the forefront of Tom Sang, UK defence policy, was this a time in the late 1930s when the LSE was sort of actively involved in the sort of discussion about the UK standing up to Hitler and engaging World War II? Were there a lot of sort of people coming in from politics and government, like happened at the LSE today, sort of taking stances for appeasement, anti-appeasement, British rearmament, all of that? And given what she later became, was there any sign, therefore, of some external influences through sort of political activism or participation, sort of not anti-war, but at least some kind of sort of political movement at the time? Just to get a flavour of that.
Sure.
Both of you bring out very well the impact of tutors and lectures.
Yeah.
But what about the external environment, which must have been very intense in London?
I think one of the first things to say is that there are always many, many views around at LSE, and that was as true, I think, in the 30s as it is as it is now. And what Margaret would have heard was probably a great range of attitudes and views towards what was happening in Europe, American attitude towards it, and all those kinds of things. And there were a lot of people here. They would, one of the other things, she would have been hearing it not only from tutors but also from students. Her fellow, she would have been studying with students who had come from the States, from Europe, from India, from Africa, and would have had a huge range of ideas and thoughts about that. There is another student who says, you know, I was just amazed. I could sit down talking to an alumni and over lunch, and I would actually hear somebody from the country telling me what it was like to have whatever it was that was happening. I didn't have to just listen to the tutors telling me what they thought theoretically it was like. So I think she would have been exposed to an enormous range of views, really.
I agree with that. I mean, you can't overgeneralise. I mean, after all, the economics department was absolutely pro-market. I mean, Robbins was pro-market, Hayek pro-market, Kozer pro-market, Arnold anti-Keynes. So, you know, there were the biggest department in the school, you might say the most influential over time, was not on the left. Indeed, it saw itself fighting the Keynesians and fighting anybody who talked about planning. So it was not a one ideological cut. Yet, nonetheless, it looks, you know, if one looks at the subject, for instance, that Margaret chose, and she could have chosen others. Okay, she was taught by people from the economics department, but it's clear that the people who influenced her most were people on the left. I mean, you know, Tawney was clearly, you know, the iconic figure of the Labour Party, and in some senses, for some of us, maybe still remains so. You know, his book on equality, The Acquisitive Society, long before he wrote his more scholarly work on religion and the rise of capitalism in 26. Eileen Power was clearly very much on the left. And as I made the indication, hope I'm not reading too much into it, she attended the lectures of Lasky, and all the descriptions of Lasky's lectures here, they were a bit like revivalist meetings. I mean, people were queuing outside because he just had that enormous intellect. And it was the 1930s, after all. Let's not forget that. There was a world depression, there was fascism, and there was the Soviet Union, which both inspired people and, I think, confused people, particularly the two webs. But that was the time, and those were the time she was living in, and I think those times are absolutely crucial for understanding her own politics. And I think you brought that up, you know, her views on the health sector. Her friends were Richard Titmuss. You know, Hancock himself was a kind of anti-establishment figure in a way. So I think those were the real background. And also, finally, I'd say simply the background she came from. You know, it was an interesting story in its own right. I'm not just telling it because we make ourselves feel sociologically good. It is because it tells an important story about possibilities that were provided through the LCC and through other things. And she came to this particular school, and I'm bound to say I don't think that was an accident, but I can't prove. She may have gone to somewhere else, of course, like Keynes. She didn't, she came here.
But she certainly retained friendship. I mean, I still remember going to Richard Titmuss's, and Anne Oakley here?
No.
But I still remember many of these people being late into in her life, very important friends and so on. Peter raises a really important point about records and so on. Peter, what I wonder, can we just hold on that for the moment? Because this is going to develop through the day, particularly the next session with David and Matt, about what should we tell Mrs. Gowing? In other words, what should be revealed? And there are other historians here as well. So can we just focus on the LSE at the moment, for the moment? Does anyone want to come in? Graham, do you want to come in on this particular point on the LSE? Graham Aylett, who was Secretary of the Public Records Committee?
Not on a specific editor.
Okay. Anything? Jill, yes.
I just wanted to say something, not about records, but I'm Jill Bennett, and official historian for over 40 years now, one of those prostituted ones.
their words, not mine.
Just adding to what was said about how Margaret came to become an official historian, I think the other element it's worth remembering is those very people who were already distinguished academics before the war, who then went into government during the war, and many of whom themselves became official historians. But that, it was a tremendous melting pot, and you're thinking of people like my own former mentor, W.N. Medlicott, and indeed Duncan Hall. There are all sorts of people who, Oliver Franks, absolute classic, who then go on to major academic careers, but also major public careers. And during the war, there are other examples. I mean, Margaret was young during the war. She was a young graduate working. And they came into contact with these people who were already very distinguished in their field. and then went on to big public careers. And I do think it's an extraordinary, I'll be looking at that a bit for Patrick, about what happened to some of these people who worked in, for example, the British Embassy in Washington during the war, and worked in various other and in departments in this country, mm. and then became both official historians and very distinguished public servants. And yeah. I think that had a great influence on Margaret, is all I'm saying.
Should I therefore maybe ask, I mean, in the few moments before we've just...
Can I have a quick reply to that?
Yeah, but I'm just going to ask if you could wrap into that, Meg, the idea of how important is it for the next generation to be, if you like, linking themselves to critical, influential people as a way of stimulating their own careers?
Well, whether it's for career purposes or purposes just for information, or purposes of being relevant. I mean, after all, my own subject of international relations has been proclaiming its irrelevance for about the last 25 years. And I'm with Laurie, we agree on this. You know, we need not just speak truth to power, that's patronising and nonsensical, but we do need to make it clear to that we do have something to say which might be worthwhile. And we can do that in all sorts of different ways. So in general terms, yes, I'm on the side of those who said if some people want to be irrelevant, fine, go away and do that. That's no problem at all. That's what universities are for and should be for. But nonetheless, I think there must be also a kind of a prospect that we actually do stuff which is useful, which in a sense is what the LSE always saw itself as being anyway. That's how the web set this whole shebang up in the first place in 1895, precisely, to be useful and to be part of the real world. On your great question, I won't go into all the detail, but it is quite extraordinary. I can only talk about the school, and I can't talk about what others were doing in other places, and I'm sure they were doing very similar kinds of things. But it is quite extraordinary, and Sue and I remember having this conversation with you, just looking at the numbers of people from the school, Margaret, just in a sense, being one person amongst many, whose huge contribution to the World War II effort in government is just quite remarkable. I'll just take two pretty obvious and straightforward examples. Lionel Robbins, whom I've already mentioned, played a huge role at Bretton Woods in the drawing up of the discussions there with Keynes. And he has this remarkable observation on Keynes, because he fundamentally disagreed with Keynes on nearly everything. He changed his mind a bit later on. He said, you kind of look at this man, this genius, and he's so admiring of Keynes, even if you disagree with him. But there he was. And by the way, C.K. Webster, Charles Kingsley Webster, who was the great second Stevenson chair here, the first being Toynbee, of course. And I love Webster, of course, because he was at my old alma mater up at Aberystwyth in the first few years. Webster was also crucial in the in the United Nations. And those are really at the very top of the tree, in a sense, you know, some of the great figures of the school. You go down the whole list, and I won't go down through, amazing kind of contribution that they made. And I think that was such a crucial turning point, too, as well. I mean, in terms of the role of universities and the role of universities in society. We can kind of talk it glibly, but there it was. And it was a crucial moment of national survival.
Let's pause, I think, for some coffee, bring it in afterwards, and let's have 15 minutes. Let me tell you my memories of Keith Hancock, and that's what he does look like, although I remember him. But this is actually more important, that pipe. I don't know how he would survive anywhere these days, because he smoked and smoked.
Everybody did.
And smoked.
Everybody did.
I should also tell you he was a brutal leg spinner. Absolutely passionate about cricket, and he also swung our cat by its tail. But those are the things I remember. But my middle name is Keith. I don't do any of those things, and I'm a lousy spinner. But he was a really important influence, and of course he went on as one of the triumvirate which set up the ANU in Canberra. So he has, and he's also seen as the greatest historian of Australia as well. So shall we pause for a moment for 50 minutes?
And thank you very much for listening.
Then what should we tell Mrs. Gowing?
Okay, thank you very much, everybody. Thank you.